Good morning. Hello, my name is Dan Fishman. I'm the Director of K-12 Programs at the Philanthropy Roundtable. Thank you all very much for choosing to join us for this session this morning. It's my pleasure to introduce us to our moderator today, Mr. Pete Guerin, the President of the Sid W. Richardson Foundation of Fort Worth, Texas. Pete joined the Richardson Foundation in March 2010. The Richardson Foundation provides grants for educational, health, human service, and cultural nonprofit organizations in Texas. Prior to joining the foundation, Pete served in the Department of Defense as Special Assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Acting Secretary of the Air Force, Undersecretary of the Army, and Secretary of the Army. In addition, Pete served four terms in the House of Representatives from 1989 to 1997. A lawyer and former business executive, he has held a leadership position in numerous civic, educational, business, and philanthropic organizations throughout Texas. Pete holds a JD and BA in history from the University of Texas at Austin. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Pete Guerin.
Dan, thank you for that introduction. And you hear that bio, you're probably wondering, what in the heck does he know about ed schools? And it's a pretty good question. That's the reason they chose me to be the moderator and chose this expert panel to answer the questions. But we do have a great panel, and I'm glad all of you chose to be with us today. A panel full of not just experts, but people who are out working in the field, rolling up their sleeves, and truly making a difference in teacher preparation. Everybody in the room knows that he asks the three most important factors in quality education for our kids. It's number one's teachers, number two, teachers, number three, teachers. And our panelists all represent different approaches, but they're all out working to improve the teacher pipeline and put better teachers in front of our kids today. Different approaches. We've got one of our panelists is working within the system to make it better. One is working kind of half in, half out, and one is working from the outside in. And each of them is making a difference in the world of teacher education and making a difference in the educational opportunities of our children as they have over their professional careers. First, I'd like to introduce Andrea Pursley. This summer, Teach for America celebrated 20 years of service to our country, putting teachers in classrooms, teacher leaders in classrooms for our kids. But Teach for America is not just putting teacher leaders in classrooms. It's also producing a whole generation of leaders who are undertaking significant education reform initiatives around the country and changing, altering the landscape of education in our country. And Andrea Pursley is one of those. She began with Teach for America after graduating from SMU in Dallas, Texas. Was with Teach for America for 8 years, began as a teacher here in Phoenix, taught the sixth grade, and then became executive director, where she had an extraordinary career there, short but extraordinary. The core went from 150 to 400 under her leadership, and the budget went from 800,000 to 6 million. She served as a national vice president for Teach for America. But she's here today to talk about the Sanford Education Project, which is an initiative within the Arizona State College of Education, where she is, and I think Mr. Sanford is in the audience today, a great partnership to work within that school to make it better. And she's using some of the lessons she learned at Teach for America, teaching as leadership, to bring reform to that school. Our next panelist is Norman Atkins. Most of you would know Norman Atkins as the founder and the former CEO of Uncommon Schools, one of the highest performing charter organizations in the nation. Under his leadership and partnership between Uncommon Schools, KIPP, and Achievement First, they began Teacher U, and now he has undertaken a new effort to prepare teachers for the classrooms in creating the Relay Graduate School of Education. This is a new school in New York that's actually chartered by the state of New York. So this is an example of working partly within the system, partly outside of the system. Last panelist is Kate Walsh. Now, there's a lot of education schools around the country. If you were to go on the campus, you would do well to not mention Kate Walsh as your friend. There's some who work within the system and some who work outside of the system, and some rock the boat. Well, Kate Walsh rocks the boat. And she is truly shaking the foundations of the ed school establishment, and I believe she's building the foundation for wholesale reform of ed schools in the future. Kate has spent her entire adult life working to try to improve the educational opportunities for kids. She's always been particularly moved by the challenges faced by children of poverty and disadvantaged by race. She began with the Baltimore schools. She developed one of the premier math and science programs for middle and secondary schools. She created a boarding school in Kenya, which I think would be an interesting subject of conversation, but to take kids from Baltimore to Kenya to get them out of a very difficult environment and help get them on the road to improvement. She's currently on the Maryland Board of State Education. And this initiative that she is working on today is a partnership with the U.S. News and World Report, and it's a Herculean task that she's undertaken, reviewing and assessing all 1,400 graduate schools all across the country. And, undergraduate and graduate schools of education around the country. And working in partnership with U.S. News and World Report, so when they finish this, it will be published nationally, and I'm confident it will start a long overdue debate over the role of those schools in our country. Audience, thank you for being here today. That wasn't supposed to be funny, I'm not sure what.
Laugh or cry.
Again, thank you for joining us today. Teachers, teachers, teachers. The role of ed schools is enormously important if you're going to talk about teachers. And you can spend a lot of time at ed reform meetings and nobody ever brings up schools of education. It's just the orphan child of the education reform movement. But when I said it's enormously important, because it's enormous. It's a $7 billion a year industry. $7 billion a year. And each year, it puts out over 200,000 teachers into the teacher pipeline. Over 80% of all the teachers. And you don't find enough people in the reform community talking about ed schools. And that's why I'm glad you're here today. I'm glad we have these great leaders who are working in this area. You all probably remember the quote by the famous bank robber, Willie Sutton. Why do you rob banks? He said, well, that's where all the money is. Why are we talking about ed schools? That's where a lot of the money is, and that's where the overwhelming majority of our teachers come from. So if you care about better teachers, you cannot ignore colleges of education. Now, I'd like to go through some quick slides and then going to give you a pop test, and then we'll get on with a conversation with our panelists. To reinforce the important role that colleges of education play in our education system today, I'd like to share these slides. I already mentioned it, 1,400 ed schools in America, $7 billion a year, and over 200,000 new teachers are certified annually. You look at the number of medical schools, and Kate might talk about the story behind why there's so few medical schools. There used to be a whole bunch before people started holding them to high standards. There are 1,400 schools of education. No shortage of poor programs. 73% of school of education professors express concern about the quality of the candidates in their program. This second bullet, I think, is particularly shocking if you're not already aware of this statistic. 70% of the teacher candidates in the ed schools come from the bottom two-thirds of their class, of their university class. Importance of a pipeline, nearly half of all educators leave the profession within 5 years. Many of you, I'm sure, as our foundation supports Teach for America, but I think it's important to keep in mind the scale that we're talking about. Teach for America graduates 5,000 core members annually, roughly. Teacher preparation programs coming out of the traditional schools, over 200,000, and that 200,000 is on the low end of the estimate. The average child in America is almost 450 times more likely to have a non-TFA teacher, to have a TFA teacher than a non-TFA teacher. So you look at this slide, that's the sliver of the population for all of us who have been funding Teach for America That's the number out there, operating in an ocean of teachers prepared by the traditional schools. Now I'd like to quickly run through a little quiz. And each of you has on your seat one of these little clickers. And Dan has emphasized to me several times, he knows I'm slow on the uptake, said these are very expensive, please don't take them with you. They've got a little bucket there on the way out, and he even has a slide he didn't think I would remember to remind you, but you're going to ask you to participate in the test, and then we're going to tabulate the results and ask you to leave your clicker as you leave. Pop quiz. Now, if you're listening carefully, we ought to get 100% on this one. What percentage of teachers are trained at a traditional school of education? 20 to 39, 40 to 59, 60 to 79, or 80 to 99? With your clicker, you just vote for 1, 2, 3, or 4. Ignore the letters on there. Just go for the number to mark your answer. Everybody had a chance to do that? Okay. Anthony? 84%. Somebody wasn't listening. Okay, question number two. This is, as philanthropists, do you currently fund traditional schools of education? One, yes. That would be true for my foundation. Number two, no, I never have. Number three, no, but I have in the past. And you might put in parentheses, but I learned my lesson, close parentheses. Okay. Results, please, Anthony. Okay. That's good. 40% do, 50% never have, 8% have in the past. All right, next question. What is your primary hesitation, if in fact you fall into that category, about funding traditional schools of education? They lack data on their effectiveness in increasing student achievement. They do more to maintain the status quo than to transform or innovate within the profession. The return on investment is greater with other programs. D, they tend to ignore donor intent. Three, human capital is not a central part of my funding strategy. And I guess to be complete, we should have given you an F other, but if you click more than once, your last answer is all that's going to register. So, okay, Anthony. Okay. They do more to maintain the status quo overwhelmingly, the answer, and I think you're going to hear that from our panelists today. Next question. What do you think is the single most important element of teacher preparation? Recruit the best teacher candidates. Provide a curriculum rooted in data and best practices. Require frequent, thoroughly evaluated student teaching experiences. Develop a deep understanding of pedagogical theory. Provide ongoing support and tracking of new teachers. And I'm sure this would be one where you'd like to click a couple, but okay, Anthony? That's interesting. Okay, recruit the best teachers and provide ongoing support, which, all right. Next question. How would you rate the likelihood that philanthropy can significantly improve traditional teacher preparation programs? Very likely. A, somewhat likely. B, not sure. C, unlikely. Very unlikely. And there was an F on here, but I struck it. I thought it was suggested a little bias in the presenters. It was when pigs fly. But okay. Anthony? Likely? Somewhat likely? Very unlikely. Well, based on that, Dan, I think we wouldn't have had many in the F category. That's great. Thank you. All right. Okay. Put the clickers on the floor or put them in the bowl on your way out. Thank you for that input. Okay. I'd like to begin with a question to Kate. Kate, you have undertaken many would consider a thankless task, and I think history will be the judge whether or not you receive the thank you that, in my opinion, you deserve. But reviewing 1,400 education colleges and graduate schools around the country, And I know from my time in government, you're experiencing this. Hell hath no fury like an offended bureaucracy. And you have offended the bureaucracy for sure. Could you share with us what you're doing, why you think it's important, and what do you hope to accomplish? What's the end of the day? What is this partnership with U.S. News and World Report and your effort going to do for our education landscape?
Well, my own background was one in which I wrote off schools of education, and I think that's probably true for a lot of the people in this room. I was a program officer for a foundation in Baltimore and bought Teach for America to Baltimore and started a resident teacher program, which is, you know, an alternative certification program, and basically decided that, you know, there was no point in trying to improve the quality of preparation provided by ed schools. And as I learned more, after I took a job running the National Council on Teacher Quality, I actually started to learn much more about what teachers need to be effective. And I came to the conclusion that Teach for America got part of, they solved a part of the puzzle. They attracted the right people into the profession. There was no question. But what Teach for America didn't do, and the results show that they didn't do, is they did not deliver, could not, cannot deliver teachers on day one who are prepared to go into the classroom. You cannot provide all the training and preparation that teachers need. But the problem is it didn't matter. So continue to fund Teach for America because ed schools aren't preparing teachers to go in on day one either to be effective. Or let's look for solutions, and I think that's both of what Norman and Andrea are doing. Let's look for a way to take what's great about Teach for America, and that's in the selectivity of the candidates, but put them through a more formal program, and you actually teach them how to teach reading. So philosophically, there was a shift in my own thinking, and I was very much inspired by two things that occurred, one of them 100 years ago. And that is Abraham Flexner. Some of you, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the Flexner study. But the Carnegie Foundation paid a school headmaster, not a doctor, interestingly enough, a school headmaster to spend 2 years on a train going around and visiting medical schools. And they did so because medical training at the time was horrendous. You could become a doctor without a high school degree. You could become a doctor without ever working on a body, live or dead. And this is in comparison to a European model of medical training, which was actually quite good. And what Abraham Flexner did was reveal a very broken system of training doctors. And within 10 years of that study coming out, a third of all the medical schools in the United States were shut down. So that study is probably the most important study done in public policy in the last century, I would argue. And, it's amazing that a study 100 years afterwards, 25% of the room will always nod, yeah, I know all about it. So certainly doctors know about it. And the other thing that we came across is David Steiner. I worked on a book with him. I was editing a book on teacher quality. And David Steiner went out and looked at 16 ed schools. And they were rated very highly by U.S. News, their grad schools. And what David learned from looking at the syllabi of those programs and some other things, he was looking only at reading instruction and a few other things, was nothing short of appalling. So he wrote about it in this book, and we published this book that no one was going to read, but it managed to really anger his colleagues. And it was a lot of controversy around it. And in fact, David was supposed to go out to University of Washington for a deanship, and they withdrew the offer. So I knew what I was getting into from the start, though I was not dependent on an ed school for a job. So we've spent the last 8 years spending about $2 million in about 8 years coming up with a set of standards that reflect what schools need in teachers on day one. So we can get into more about what actually we do ask. But that's basically how we got to this point. We have now partnered with U.S. News. Certainly the ed schools did not care what NCTQ had to say. It was only after we brought in the big guns that anybody really cared whether we came out and said they weren't doing what they needed to do. So it will be, we're in the middle of a battle, there's no question, and we'll talk a little bit more about that over the morning, but that's basically the how we got to where we are today.
Will you mention what you intend to do with the results and the partnership with U.S. News and World Report?
So we will give a grade to these schools. We're not doing all 1,400. In fact, there are 300 that only educate less than 1% of all teachers in the United States. So we'll do about 1,150. And we will give a grade, and we'll keep coming back, because that's how ratings work. We know college ratings are extremely motivating for institutions. And I recognize that some college rating systems are not particularly good ones. What we've tried to do is to put a very comprehensive, fair, and meaningful way of looking at these schools. So institutions, one of the surprising features of this whole program, this whole endeavor, has been the degree to which higher ed chancellors and college presidents have turned on us. I went into this under the assumption that college presidents and chancellors and, you know, provosts would be on board because they secretly, well, not, it's not that secretive, but they hold ed schools in a lot of disdain. And they're always sort of the poor stepchild on the campus. Education professors don't enjoy the status of other college professors. So I thought, this has been the big learning point for me, is I thought the university presidents would say, yeah, go, let's learn something, let's do something here. I've always wanted to do something in my ed school. That's not happened. In fact, it's been remarkable the degree to which the hierarchy has stuck with the ed schools on this. Mm-hmm. So, but we do know they don't like getting a bad grade. And they will change, and that will be the one thing that will make them change. The other thing we're going to be doing is sending inspection teams into schools at the request of state school chiefs. So we have at the moment 10 school chiefs who endorse this work. We'll go back to those state school chiefs and say, do you want us to send an objective, well-trained team into your low-performing schools and decide if we should recommend them for program, that you withdraw program approval? So, those are just two of the things that we intend to do with this. So we intend to very much impact the marketplace, and we are, also going to work with some of the more brave, state school chiefs. And there are an increasing number of brave school chiefs, so this is heartening for us to really put some muscle behind what we're doing.
Thank you, Kate. Andrea, you're working within the system. You are working within a long-established education college at Arizona State University. Can you tell us about the Sanford Education Project and what your plans are for that, and also talk about how it has been to work within a long-standing teacher education program?
Sure. So I'll start with the second question first. The notion of being in a traditional school of education, I think, is interesting at ASU. For any of you who have ever met or heard from President Michael Crow, you know that ASU is anything but traditional. And the same is true for our dean. So I think there are some really positive things about being in a traditional college. Our students get to become teachers in an undergraduate degree program. They get to do that while they are, attending football games and going to school and living in the dorm. And I think that, you know, ideally, teachers would be able to be trained and receive excellent training to be excellent first-year teachers within a traditional school, in that it is an undergraduate degree. At ASU, I think there are a lot of things that are not traditional. Our university president got on national television and said, there's a massive achievement gap in Arizona between students who are achieving and students who aren't, and even those who aren't achieving at the levels that they should, and we have some responsibility in that, and we need to fix it. The dean of our College of Education has taken a lot of really bold steps. So before the Sanford Education Project had started, our dean had already given up 40% of the education courses in our program in favor of a more rigorous content curriculum for our elementary school teachers so that they would deeply know the content that they would go and teach. So I think just a little bit of context on whether ASU is in fact a traditional school is helpful. The Sanford Education Project was born out of an idea of Mr. T. Denny Sanford, there in the front row, to combine the best practices of Teach for America as an organization with the best practices of a traditional school of education. There are five major components of the project. The first is all about talent, all about recruiting talent, and recruiting talented students into a school of education. And as you saw, I think you said 75% of students in schools of education traditionally come from the bottom two-thirds. That's actually not what we see at ASU. Currently, 65% of our students have entered college-ready with no remediation. 44% are scholar students who would be receiving academic scholarship also in a school of biology, also in a school of engineering. And we've set really high goals for this year to increase that to 75% college-ready without remediation, 50% scholar students, and we believe we're on track to do that. The second major component is building a predictive admissions and progression model. Our goal is not to become so selective that we accept 10% of our applicants like Teach for America. Our goal is to become predictive at the admissions. When we accept a student, what do we need to know about them to know that they are likely to have a dramatically positive impact on student learning in their first year of teaching? What do we need to know at the end of that freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, before student teaching, during student teaching, to be able to predict the success of that teacher as measured by student achievement gains? The third major portion of our project is building in more clinical responsibility. Over the last year, we have gone from a traditional student teaching model of 15 weeks. You go in, you go out. A lot depends on the quality of the mentor, and not much depends on the quality of the program. We've gone from that model to a year-long student teaching model in a co-teaching model with responsibility for student achievement that is measured. We piloted this last year with 40 students, and we have expanded that to 500 students this year. So it's a big step. We certainly have a lot to continue learning. The fourth part, and I'm almost done, is support of our first-year teachers. We're going to be building out different pilots to pilot programs and research projects to support the success of our first-year teachers as measured by student achievement and their commitment to the profession, and figure out, you know, what the differential impact is of different types of support, and then over time figure out what's scalable, what's affordable, what's replicable for a college of education to do in terms of taking responsibility for the performance of their first-year teachers as graduates. And then finally, we've been charged by Mr. Sanford with the goal of figuring out what works, researching what works, and then sharing what works broadly within the education community. So that's a brief overview. We've been at it for about a year and a half. We've learned a lot. We certainly have a lot left to learn. So.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. And I'm going to, as we get a little further into the conversation, I want all of y'all to talk about what is next and the issue of scaling up. Could you just talk briefly, Andrea, about the reception you received when you came to the School of Education as a former Teach for America person? And I think that a lot of people would assume that there would be a tremendous resistance within the education school establishment to a bunch of outsiders coming in and trying to tell them how to do their business.
Yes, I think that is definitely an accurate perception. And me coming from 8 years at Teach for America, I did have a little bit of fear that I might be walking in with sort of a bullseye on my chest, you know, Teach for America person coming in. That has not been the case. I mean, there's certainly been a lot of questions, but I had the opportunity to work with Dean Mary Kerner for years prior to starting in this role from Teach for America. I approached her and said, I think together we could actually build a better teacher. I think we're doing a really great job with a lot of pieces of this, but I think that if you could build a graduate program that focused on methods courses in the content areas for our teachers, and we could implement that, we could together build better teachers. And we started that work together in 2006. So mm-hmm. I wasn't a stranger coming into the School of Education, which I think helped a lot. And you know, there is a real openness to change and to figuring out what works and to doing it within the School of Education where I work.
That's great. Norman, you're hybrid. You're starting a new school. I don't know how often that happens. You've certainly been seen as an innovator within the school reform movement, but you've created this new school, Relay. You've sought a state charter. So you're now with kind of 1 foot within the establishment, and you certainly come from outside of the establishment. Can you tell us about Relay, how you decided to do that, and what's different about it from a traditional education school?
So the problem that we're trying to solve is not making ed schools better. Can you all hear me?
It's not particularly good.
Yours seems a little lower than... Maybe if you move your mic up too a little bit, I'm not sure if it's...
Keep talking. The problem that we're trying to solve is not to make better ed schools. The problem we're trying to solve is that there's a four-year achievement gap in this country, that low-income students are 4 years behind their more affluent peers. The greatest escalator for those kids to achieve is education. And the thing that makes the biggest difference, you said this, is the teachers. So we got to get more great teachers into the classrooms of low-income students. I'm sitting down having a beer with David Levin, who's one of the founders of KIPP, and we're talking about how are we going to get more teachers for our growing numbers of schools. And in New York, we were under a lot of pressure through No Child Left Behind to have a highly qualified teacher in every classroom. But a highly qualified teacher in every classroom in New York is a highly certified teacher. And in New York, to have certification, you either have to have a master's degree or be in the process of getting a master's degree. So all of our teachers are going off to get master's degrees from institutions where they're learning all the things that are wrong for our schools. And so we had to counter-program them. So we said, why don't we start our own training program, both to improve the quality of preparation of our teachers and to take the most effective practices in our schools and spread them out more widely. And so we originally went around and talked to about 10 university presidents and deans and found this gentleman who Kate mentioned, David Steiner, at Hunter College, which is part of City University, and he was waiting for us with open arms. We decided to work there, and we created an innovative program called TeacherU. It took us very little time to realize that deans and presidents have very little power within higher education. The power belongs to the tenured faculty who comprise faculty senates and who get to really decide the program in these higher ed institutions. And so essentially, if we wanted to become long-term an A-plus program turning out great teachers, we needed to have financial sustainability, and we needed to have autonomy, we needed to have the freedom to push for more radical reform. And so we decided to petition the state of New York to become an independent higher ed institution. Reason why we decided to do that instead of becoming a random teacher prep program is simply because states like New York are requiring the master's degrees, and in other states where they require certification, it makes a lot of sense to do it within higher education, because the kinds of people who are becoming teachers, the kinds of high selective folks that we're seeing in TFA, they want to get a master's degree. And either they have a financial incentive, either they're going to make more money in their jobs as a result of union contracts where you're rewarded for having a master's degree, or they're going to become better teachers. And in the new paradigm where great teaching is rewarded, they should be able to do better. A couple of things that make us different. We're teaching practical techniques about how to teach. We're not teaching a lot of theory and asking people to write papers about the theory. We're asking them to film themselves. Everybody gets a flip video camera. They film themselves, and their assignments are to demonstrate the techniques and strategies. A colleague of mine, Doug Lamov at Uncommon Schools, wrote a book called Teach Like a Champion and codifies these techniques. It's not rocket science. 400,000 people across the country have bought this particular book and are starting to figure out how to teach in classrooms. We're also showing examples, videos, of what great teaching looks like. We're using data to drive instruction. We're teaching character. We've got our professors, our faculty, are not people who are great researchers who have a ton of letters after their names. They're people who are really good teachers who know how to teach. And they've gotten results in classrooms serving low-income kids, and they're working with the teachers in our program. And then we've got a gate for graduation. You've got to demonstrate that you can teach, but you also have to demonstrate that your students can learn. So at the end of 2 years in our program, you have to show that your students have made at least a year's worth of growth, not so difficult, not so radical, in order to get your degree. And we've set it up so that it's not based on seat time. So most programs, 36 credits, 450 hours, you sit there, you write the papers, you're in the bottom two-thirds, you get your degree, you go on, you get more money, etc. We're saying you demonstrate the techniques and strategies, you show it on video, you can move through the program as fast as you can or as slow as you have to. So it might take some people less time to finish, might be that some people will take more time. That's the some of the key differences in our program, and we have received mixed reception. There are a lot of people who are enthusiastic about a new program. There are a lot of people in other higher ed institutions who think we are barbarians at the gate. Where is your library? Where are your research studies? Where are your faculty with all of those credentials? You don't yet look like you should belong in the club. And to us, it looks like a freaking monopoly. And in order for there to be reform, you need to show new kinds of models. We've seen this in the charter movement. If there were not charter schools, we would not have seen the innovation that we've had over the past two decades. If there were no TFA, there would be no kinds of reform that we're seeing out of that institution. So we're trying to become an entrepreneurial institution within higher education and try to lead the way toward a new way of doing this. We're very early on, making a lot of progress, excited about the permission to operate in New York.
How many students do you project?
So we have currently 225 in the first of a two-year program in New York. We've got 150 who are finishing up the program, a teacher at Hunter College. We've got 75 in Newark. We hope to get to about 1,000 in New York and about 10,000 across the country.
You say 10,000 across the country. Now, how will you deliver the educational product across the country?
So it's challenging to thread the needle politically to get permission to operate as a new institution in each state, and it's challenging to get accredited as we get to operate in New York and New Jersey, and as we get accredited, our thought is to open up campuses in other states across the country.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, you heard Norman talk about some of the challenges working within education schools and why he decided to go outside of them. You talked about the reception that you've gotten at Arizona State, but school's been there a long time. You've got a bunch of tenured faculty that have been doing it their way for a long time. What kind of chances do you see for actually bringing about a transformation of the approach to teacher preparation among the whole faculty, and not just be a little subset or a little bubble within a great big teacher college?
Great question. So first, I think a little bit more context is probably helpful. At ASU, there are four campuses, and there used to be four colleges of education 5 years ago. That is dwindled down to now one college of education. 2 months before I started in this role, the large graduate college of education, which housed the majority of our tenured faculty, was disestablished. And the dean of what was the College of Teacher Education and Leadership, a small college on the West Campus that also housed the undergraduate programs, now houses all of the programs. So there's been actually quite a bit of change based on looking at outcomes prior to me starting and prior to the Sanford Education Project that I think is just helpful to know. In terms of not wanting to be a bubble within the College of Education, this is something I'm very cognizant of and looked at a lot before even in taking this job or starting in this job. And one of the things that I think was really quite brilliant, actually, on the part of Mr. Sanford and Dean Kerner and President Crowe was to structure this gift so that it isn't a bubble. It isn't a project on the side. It's meant to actually orchestrate a change of everything that's happening within the College of Education. So when we talk about the senior year residency that we rolled out this year, it isn't a small number of our students. It isn't, 40 of our students to pilot this with. Like, we rolled it out with 500 students. We have 3,400 undergraduate students in our college, and the work that we're doing is impacting all of them. So really, we're trying these things out at scale, which means that we're engaging in these struggles at scale. We aren't figuring something out on the side and then bringing it back in and saying, so what does everybody think? We're having those things are all happening at the same time. And so there have been some pretty tough choices to make it at the College of Ed. One has been about who gets what positions, who gets to make what decisions. And these are major questions. One thing that has been, I think, a huge step forward, but certainly really challenging among our clinical faculty is that the role of a traditional clinical faculty member, teach 5 courses on campus in the fall, 5 courses on campus in the spring, that's your job, that's going away in favor of this new senior residency model where the role of a clinical faculty member is to teach 3 courses and supervise 30 teacher candidates, assess them formally 5 times during the year using the TAP rubric, assess them informally every week. This has become a really, really hard job. And a really, really high level, challenging, high expectations job that's very different from what a traditional role has been. So as we've made these changes within our project, these changes have been made at a larger scale within the university, within the college. So it is challenging. And yes, a lot of what we're doing challenges lots of traditional ideas about what should be. But we're taking on that battle all at once, and each step that we make is not a step to create something that maybe will be integrated, but it's actually the step of integrating it.
Well, thank you for those insights. Kate, I want to ask you a question. Others could join in as well, but why has the market not driven reform of ed schools? If you're a business school and you're producing a product that does not add value in a business, the business school goes out of business. If you're a med school, you're putting out doctors that kill people, you go out of business. Ford Motor Company produces an Edsel, and I think I'm showing my age using that example. People don't buy it, and they quit making it. Why has the market not driven reform of these ed schools? These are close to the people. They touch the people in the most personal, profound way that government touches people. It affects the future of their kids. Why hasn't the market not responded to the job that they're doing?
I think there's a couple of explanations for that. One is there is no standard of excellence in the field. We know what a really good medical school looks like and what it does. We know what a really good law school looks like and it does. We don't have that, and I can tell you we've done 10 pilot studies at this point, that people seriously underestimate the degree of chaos that characterizes the field of teacher education. I mean, you can have an institution on one part of town that requires middle school teachers to take one biology course. And you go 2 miles down the road and look at another institution training teachers and they take 9 biology courses. You look at, what it is that we consider the content preparation for the elementary teacher. Pretty much anything goes. I mean, there is no standard. And that's what we felt we delivered to this conversation. We actually had the hubris to develop a set of standards. And we didn't do it on our own. We did, we looked at research. We looked at what the best practices of other nations were. I mean, it was a long, involved process. But the reaction from the teacher education community, they're somewhat horrified by the fact that there is someone out there saying there's a right way to prepare a teacher and there is a wrong way to prepare a teacher. Because very much in their mindset is, whatever I want to do is what I should be able to do. And the other answer to your question, I think, is I don't think people seriously appreciate how different the mindset is on many ed school campuses. I mean, you sort of have a general sense that it's the coursework's kind of Mickey Mouse, and you know, you hear all the sort of anecdotal evidence. But if you'll bear with me, I'm going to tell you sort of three very quick anecdotes, which I think capture what is going on in ed schools, or too many ed schools. And I want to underscore this, is we're making generalizations today. There are really good ed schools out there, but I'm going to talk to the preponderance of behavior. And first of all, ed schools don't really believe in accountability or tests. They don't think tests are a useful measure of whether their teachers are doing a good job or what students are learning. So that sort of challenges sort of a basic tool of education. I was giving us a talk about this project, and there were ed school deans in the audience. And I tend to talk a lot about how when you assign a first grader a really great teacher year in and year out, that first grader will be reading at 12th grade level by 8th grade. And if you assign a really bad teacher year in, year out, that same child would be reading at the 4th grade level. So look at the difference between the outcomes based on the teacher you put before them. So I thought, you know, it's a fairly, you know, harmless reflection of the actual research, I thought. Well, one of the deans from a very prestigious place, and that's important to keep in mind, too, the prestige here doesn't matter at all. In fact, you can often argue that the more prestigious schools are the biggest problem in terms of teacher preparation. So she was I'm going to say the university. It's University of Pennsylvania. And she said, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you mean by fourth grade level. If you'd given that child a passage about dinosaurs, maybe that child would have read at the 12th grade level. And I said, so you're saying that there is no subjective measure of reading ability. That's right. That's what I'm saying. Now, another example is we have now looked at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of syllabi for reading instruction. So our knowledge is as deep as anyone in the world right now on what is going on in reading instruction in the United States of future elementary teachers. If you look at those syllabi, the number one assignment to teachers is to journal about how you think children ought to learn how to teach reading. So to call upon your own experience as a way to inform how you will teach reading to the children that come before you in a few years. But in addition to that, the most prevalent philosophy for teaching reading is to develop your own approach to teaching reading. You, 21 years old, likely to never have read anything about reading research. I doubt if you've read Jean Chahl. I doubt if you've read Marilyn Adams. I doubt if you've done any of the thousands of hours of research has been done by NIH on how you teach kids how to read.
Coming from the bottom two-thirds of your class.
And coming from the bottom, you are supposed to come up with your own approach to teaching reading. And that's what our teachers are hearing. Now, I'm going to leave with one last anecdote, and I'm sorry to monopolize. But there's a book called Studying Teacher Education that was put out about 5 years ago. And it was brought in all the big guns in the field of teacher education. And it was a really commendable effort. They were asking themselves the question, are we making a difference? And they looked at every aspect of teacher preparation, and they looked at the research behind it as to whether ed schools were actually contributing to making better teachers. Great, great concept. And I went through and I read every one of the pages, and there were 810 pages to this book. And I read them each about 5 times because I couldn't quite get over it. And so as I was going through it, I was looking for the words achievement gap. The achievement gap is referenced once in 810 pages. It is not even on the radar of the field of teacher education that this is the number one problem in this country, and what are we doing to solve it?
Thank you. That is, we want to make sure we have time for questions, but I'd like to, each of the three of you have been part of activist efforts in the school, in the field of education reform. It would seem to me that to get from where we are today to where we need to be, there's no substitute for effective advocacy, effective work in the public policy arena, whether it's with charter schools, alternative certification, or Kate, your work in the public policy advocacy arena. I'd like to hear your thoughts, your advice to the audience on what needs to be done in the advocacy arena to take this issue on. Norman mentioned the impact that charter schools have had, and that's been no easy fight over the years, harder in some states than others. But Norman, if you think about the efforts to take on this $7 billion industry that produces 200,000 plus teachers a year, what kind of lessons can you share with us from your work in the charter school movement that might help all of us as philanthropists move the needle when it comes to ed schools?
So I'm less focused on advocacy than proof points. Mm-hmm. I feel like there are a dozen good schools of education around the country out of the 1,400. There are a couple of good teacher preparation programs, but basically the field is pretty darn empty. If this is so important, we need to get more players onto the field. So we need to be investing in and supporting the most creative entrepreneurs who are willing to build the teacher preparation pipelines in the various cities and states around the country. That would be my number one agenda item. Two, it is very tempting to write a check to your alma mater. We all love walking around the place where we went to college, especially on a pretty day. And it is easy for us to be tempted by an incredibly inspiring president or dean about the value of putting teacher education on the map at that particular place. But I worry that the philanthropy won't hit its target with that particular approach, and that we really have to go outside and use a battering ram by creating new institutions and new initiatives that will force change along with the kinds of efforts that that Kate is describing. I would just put a note of caution onto reforming existing institutions, and I would encourage us to invest in education entrepreneurs in the higher ed sector in the same way that we've done in the K-12 sector.
Okay. Thank you. And Andrea, I'll ask you to answer it, and then I want to go to the audience for questions. But one thing Mr. Lynch mentioned last night, he said for the longest time the unions kept TFA out of Boston. And as you're with your work as a executive or as a vice president of TFA, I'm sure you've seen the political battles over the country that TFA has fought over the years. Think about reforming ed schools. Think about your experience with TFA. What needs to be done to get this movement going?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a few thoughts. One is that I do think Teach for America is doing a lot right. And I do think that if we want to see, like, people who are on a path to be leaders in whatever field they choose, and we want to see more of them choosing education as the field in which they're going to lead, I think that Teach for America is essential. I also think that in an industry that prepares 200,000 teachers a year, we need to be very, very thoughtful about having more than three solutions to talk about. Like, I agree with Norm. We need to have lots of solutions. This is an enormous problem. And we need to have lots of different proof points, different examples of success. You know, my hope and my intent with the Stanford Education Project is to be able to develop a model that is replicable, to be able to develop small models for that could be implemented in other schools of education, and it won't cost $20 million each time. And so my hope is that 3.5 years from now we'll have toolkits that say if you want to reform an existing school of education, here are some ways to do it. Learn from what we learned. And we've learned some interesting lessons that I didn't anticipate learning. I mean, things that seem silly. It's really hard to drive new applications to a college of education. We have presented at over 200 high schools this fall, a full-time recruitment team of 8, and we have driven very few new applications. But it's really easy to get talented kids who have applied excited about their application and admission and get them to come. We see a path to tripling the matriculation rates of promising students, but we haven't seen a lot of movement on generating new applications. I mean, these are interesting and important and insightful lessons that I hope that other schools of education can also learn from, and I hope that that we won't take away from this conversation the lesson that it can never be done in a college of education, because I believe that's fundamentally untrue. I do think that as philanthropists, you have all of the power. So when you write that check, make sure that there are lots of strings attached, and make sure that those strings point directly to student learning and student achievement, and that you are guiding the gift that you have given, not just the day you give it, but all the way through.
I want to thank the Philanthropy Roundtable for putting this on. You can go to a lot of education conferences, and you never hear people talking about ed schools. $7 billion, 200,000 plus teachers every single year. And this panel, three people who are working diligently to make significant reforms in such a huge part. I want to thank all of you for participating today, and thank you for what you're doing out there in the vineyards. And Mr. Sanford, thank you for the work that you're doing, the pioneering work with Arizona State and with Andrea. Thank all of you for being here. Thanks for your interest in EdSchools.